We're studying the Megillah again after we had an overview of the Megillah, and this time we're going to begin with all the introductions we need. We had a short summary of the story of the Megillah, and now we're assuming everyone knows the story, and we're going to start with the introduction. And God plans on creating a world, Jewish people, a Mashiach. These are thoughts that we saw in Pirkei Rabbi Elazar preceded the creation of the world. And we're going to see that our Megillah revolves around these thoughts. Our Megillah revolves around the Jewish people, around the temple, around the Mashiach, and obviously around God. When God creates the world, God does so by creating one place and then extrapolating from there. That one place, the first place that God created, is the Evan HaSiyah, the stone in the Holy of Holies. God began by creating the most holy place in the world, in the Temple Mount. And God took from that earth and created the first man, Adam HaRishon, with his own two hands, so to speak, whatever that means. We have years pass, so we reach the year 1948, Avram is born. The year 2448, the Jews leave Egypt. 2448 years after creation. When Avram is 100 years old, the year 2048, God tells him 30 years earlier, when Avram is 70, that his offsprings will be exiled into a land that is not theirs. And then when Yitzchak is born in the year 2048, so that's when the clock starts ticking for the 400 years until 2448, the Jews leave Egypt. They spend 40 years in the desert and then enter the land of Israel in the year 2488. And now they're going to be in the land of Israel for a few hundred years until the temple is built, and the temple is erect for a few hundred years. During the period where the temple is built, King Solomon's reign, the Jews are united, and we'll discuss King Solomon at greater length in a few minutes. King Solomon is tremendously wealthy, he has peace, he is tremendously wise, he knows the secrets of how the world works, and he erects a tremendous throne. The throne that he builds is famous. Everyone's heard about it throughout the land. Every nation has agreed to be subservient to Shlomo. They all send him gifts, except for one, which we'll read about in a second. When Shlomo built his throne, so give me just one second, we'll get the source. He covered it with purified gold. Pure gold, excellent. Exceptional rubies and diamonds, and no one had ever seen a throne as awesome as Shlomo's throne. It had 12 gold lions standing by it, and opposite the 12 gold lions there were 12 gold eagles, and the eagles would face the lions. You had 12 lions facing 12 eagles. On the throne you'd have 6 steps, and on each step you had 2 gold animals, one on the right and one on the left. On the first step you had a golden ox, and opposite it you had a golden lion. On the second step you had a golden wolf, and opposite it a golden lamb. On the third step you had a golden leopard, and opposite it a golden camel. On the fourth step a golden eagle, and opposite it a golden duck. On the fifth step, a golden cat, and opposite it, a golden rooster. On the sixth step, you had a golden eagle, and opposite it, a golden dove. And on top of the throne, you had a golden dove holding in its hand a golden eagle. And this represents the 12 tribes and the kingdoms which would be overcome, until finally the dove, which represents the Jewish people, is holding the eagle. Which shocks me a little bit, if you think about which nations took the eagle as their representative. And this is supposed to represent that in the end the dove, the Jewish people, which are represented by the dove, notice that very often they show the dove holding the alei zeit, the olive branch, that's always being representative of the Jewish people. The dove is always our representative. Yonati b'chagvei ha'sela, the verse states in Shir Hashir. What? It also represents peace, right? Yeah.
Where do we find that?
This is a medrash on Esther. There's a medrash on Miguel's Esther. That you have to speak to someone who knows more depth. There is a significance for each animal and why they are there. Now, the animals, Shlomo HaMelech made them in a way that when he just stepped, it would be like an escalator. Each animal would pick up his foot and put it onto the next animal's hand, and they'd lift him this way, bringing him up to the throne. On top of the throne, there was a menorah, a candelabra of gold, and it had 7 branches coming out of each side, a total of 14 branches. Now, on the 7 branches on one side, it had the 7 fathers of the world: Adam, Noah, Shem, Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, and Eov. Their portraits were engraved on each one of the branches. And on the other side, you had 7 branches, and on them were the 7 Hasidim of the world: Levi, Kehas, Amram, Moshe, Aaron, Eldad, Medad, and Hur. And on top of the menorah was a pitcher of gold. What? Who what?
Mizrahi, the granite.
What about them?
They were on the top of the menorah. You said the Hasidim were on the bottom, so...
On top of the menorah there was a pitcher filled with olive oil, from which they would take the oil to fill the lamps in the base of Mikdash. And under the menorah was a huge basin of gold filled with pure olive oil, from which they would light this menorah, this candelabra. And on it were engraved a picture of the Kohen Gadol and 2 gold as though you had gold wheat stalks growing from this basin, and on each of these stalks were engraved the 2 sons, a son of Eli, the Kohen Gadol, Hophni and Pinchas, and in between them, in between these gold stalks, would come out gold pipes on which they had engraving a picture of Aaron's 2 sons, Nadav and Avihu. And he had a gold seat for the Kohen Gadol and the Vice Kohen Gadol, the Sian Kohen Gadol, right near him. And around, surrounding the throne, he had 70 gold seats for the Sanhedrin, who would sit opposite him and sit in ruling or to judge the Jewish people faithfully. Near his head, he had 2 gold fish that he won't like fall off. They were, I guess, supporting him. And above his head, he had 24 gold grapevines that would give him shade. Whenever he wanted to go somewhere, this seat was able to go with him. And when he'd approach, as he was being escalated up the steps, so he had a gold eagle who was perched over his throne, and it would fly down, swoop down with his crown and place it on his head.
Is it mechanical or is it like a miracle type of thing?
Good question. When I was a child, so we were told this is part of Shlomo's wisdom, that he knew secret incantations. Now that I saw the Medrash inside, so the Medrash seems to say they were galgalim. There were all kinds of things that turned that made all of this work. That it was Shlomo's wisdom. It doesn't say gears. It says that he had these silver crocodiles next to his throne, and it would turn and everything else would turn and move. But it seems like it was on autopilot. It doesn't seem like it was gears. There was something making it move, because we're going to see that when other kings captured this throne and they tried to get on the step, they didn't know how the step worked, and the lion's hand went up to shift them up, and they didn't know it, and it whacked their thighs so strongly. It had to be strong. Figure if it's carrying a person's weight, so it moves strongly, that it made 2 kings into cripples, Paro Necho and Nebuchadnezzar. They both had a limp because they didn't know how to use the throne. They tried to ascend this throne. So this was a throne that was known all over the world. Where is it now is a good question. It was captured, and I'm not sure where it is now.
It seems like it would be something pretty big. How is
Yeah, must have been huge.
So somebody You mean like captures and lifting it?
They had many people capturing and lifting it. It's not one person. They had their whole army coming into Jerusalem. So this throne was known worldwide. I'm only telling you part of what happened. He had stuff there that made noise, different creatures made of gold, and when a witness would come to testify, he'd make them all start flapping their wings and making their noises, and it was so scary that a person would be scared to testify falsely. This was awesome. You stand in front of a king and you see such a throne, and you see such mechanics, which in those days were magical. How Shlomo did it, I don't know. This was part of his wisdom, whether there were gears or it was with incantations or how, I don't know. But Shlomo, we have on tradition, knew how to speak the language of every living creature. So I don't know. It says he had his oxen and lions and wolves, and all his animals would let out their roars when a witness would step before him, and he wouldn't dare lie in front of this wisdom. He sees that he controls all the animals. Yeah.
With all these statues and everything, how did he have these statues?
Good question. I was wondering about it too, because the Gemara asked how you could have an engraving of different animals and human faces. I didn't see anyone that discusses it. I don't know. The question also bothered me. How could you have that? How did that work?
No one discusses it at all.
I didn't see no one discuss it. I didn't see.
It seems like that would be like a major thing.
Something, okay. Could be this discussed. I didn't understand.
No, but like,
could be. Well, I don't know. I don't know.
Rabbi, if he knew the incantation, though,
would
that be like magic?
What?
Wouldn't that be magic?
Maybe it was God's secret names, the holy way of making things work. I don't know.
Do you think it's to make those things work?
I don't know. Yeah. Jeff, you want something?
No, I don't. Oh.
Okay. No, sir, it's not wine, yeah.
I hope nobody is filming me now, but I read in the Quran and the Surah of
Sorry! Yeah?
You have to know what the anime is thinking about. And I was reading about, and I was reading about the story about the Queen of Bathsheba coming to King Shlomo, and there's also the discussion about this throne. And there, for example, they said that he was dealing with Shaitim, that he banned Shaitim into the throne, and that the Shaitim were working.
Could be. It says that he had control over Shaitim also. What? I don't know. So. We have the great King Shlomo that everyone was scared of, and when Shlomo was king, so every nation feared him, and every nation would send him gifts and honor him, and all the animals came to honor him, and Shlomo checked, and he saw that there was one animal that wasn't present, and that was what's called Ziz Shaddai, which might be the wild rooster. One kind of bird that didn't show up. So Shlomo said, what's this disrespect that this bird doesn't show up? So they checked it out, and finally they brought a representative before it. And the bird said, look, please, my master, the king, listen, let me tell you what I have to say. It's 3 months that I've been thinking, I haven't eaten or drank, and I said, you know, I'll fly out throughout the world to see if there's a kingdom that hasn't heard of you. And I found one kingdom far out in the east. They have, their land is paved with gold, and they throw out silver like garbage, and the trees have been planted since the time of Bereshit. They drink water from Gan Eden. They have a great army. They wear golden crowns. They don't have to fight any wars. They're not interested in fighting wars. They don't shoot bow and arrow or anything. They're a peaceful nation, and they're a truthful nation. They don't know what it means to lie. And I saw that the ruler of this nation was a woman, and her name is the Queen of Sheba, Malkat Sheva. And she doesn't know about your existence. That's the one kingdom around that doesn't know you exist. And if I find favor in your eyes, I want to fly out there and I'll bind them all up, all these people that they don't have respect for you, and I'll bring them to you, my master, the king. So the king thought, gee, this is an interesting idea. He called his scribes, and he wrote a letter, and he put it on the wings of this bird. And the bird swooped to the heavens and flew out to the east, to the land of the Queen of Sheba. And as he flew over there, he brought with him many, many birds. And when they came to the city, so it was early in the morning, and the queen had gotten up to bow down to the sun. They served the sun in this city. And when she turned to the sun to doubt it, it was darkness because all these birds were coming towards her. And she tore her clothing and she said, "It can't be, my God is dead, no sun, what's going on?" And as she's standing there in utter shock, this bird swoops down to her and gives her a letter that's on his wing. And she reads the letter. And the letter says, "This is from the King Shlomo, peace be with you and peace to your officers. Don't you know that God made me king over the world, and I rule over all the animals and over all the spirits and all the demons, all the kings of east, west, north, and south? They come and they ensure peace with me. And if you want to make peace with me, it would be, I'll give you a great honor. And if you don't, then I'll send my armies and we're going to take care of you. And you know who my armies are? They're the wild animals and the birds and the demons. And I could send everyone to take care of you. So I want to make peace with you." The Queen of Sheba heard this. She went to the elders. She asked them, "What do you think?" And they said, "We never heard of this Solomon." She said, "Okay, I'm ignoring you." She said, they said, "What do we need him for? What do we care what he says?" So she says, "No. If he was able to do this, I'm interested." So she loaded ships with great wood and jewels. And she sent it to Shlomo with 6,000 young boys and girls, each of them the same age, each of them born on the same day, and each of them the same height, all of them wearing royal clothing. And she sent a letter to King Shlomo, "From me here, 7 years distance from the land of Israel, I want to come and see your land, and in 3 years' time, I will come to visit you." And 3 years passed, and she came to Shlomo to Jerusalem. And when Shlomo heard that she was coming, so he sent Benayahu ben Yoyada to greet her. And Benayahu was so good looking, it was like the morning sun rising. So as she's coming up to Jerusalem, she sees this beautiful man. And she gets off her chariot, and he asks her, "What are you getting off your chariot for?" So she says, "Aren't you the great King Solomon?" So he says, "No, I'm his servant." So the Queen of Sheba turned back and she said, "You see, if we haven't seen the lion, we've seen those that crouch around him. This is the man who serves him." So she came to Shlomo. When Shlomo heard she was coming, he left his throne, and he sat in a house that was of solid glass. And the glass was so clear that when she came in, she thought he was sitting in water. So she picked up her skirt to enter the water, and he saw her legs with hair. So he said to her, he said, "Your beauty is the beauty of women, and your hair is the hair of men." I don't know, and hair is beauty for men and a disgrace for women. Now, I don't know why the Medrash has to say this. I don't know of what importance this is, but this is what it says, so I'm giving you the full version.
I don't imagine that you're from saying a thing like that, besides the fact that it's not a nice thing to say.
Right, I agree. The question is, what is the Medrash telling us? I agree, it doesn't seem to make sense on the literal sense, so what is the Medrash telling us? So the queen tells the king, "I'll give you three riddles, and if you could figure them out, I'll know you're a wise person, and if not, you're like everyone else." So she said, the first riddle, "The well is of wood, and the vessel that they draw from is of metal. What you draw is stone, and really it's fluid like water. What is it?" So Shlomo said, "This is the thing you dip your eyeshadow into. That you take a metal, thing to dip into a wooden thing that has eyeshadow that comes from stone. And it comes out liquid and you put it on your eyes." So she said, "Okay. Next question. Dirt from the ground comes out and it ends up eating dirt from the ground. It's poured like water and it looks at the house. What is it?" So Shlomo said, "This is tar. Tar comes out from the ground. It's like dirt from the ground. And it ends up being facing the wall with like dirt, and it faces the house." So she said, "Okay, and my last riddle."
What was the riddle again?
She said, dirt from the ground goes out, and it eats dirt from the ground, and it's poured like water, and it looks at the house. What is it? The last question she asked him is, strong wind passes through its head and yells a great yell, a great bitter yell, bends its head like one whose head is bent. It's a praise for the wealthy people and a shame for the poor. It's honor for the dead and it's pain for the life. It's happiness for the birds and it's a sorrow, mourning for the fish. What is it? And Shlomo said to her, it's pishta, it's flax. Now, I don't know how that answers the riddle. I don't get, I didn't get it. I don't know. Yeah, pishta. I guess they use the flax, which is flax. I don't know if it's because of the oil. I assumed it was that when they make things out of the type of material that's made of flax is something that's very light, and maybe the poor have only that to wear in the winter, and the rich wear that even in the summer, and the dead they embalm it with, but the life don't like it unless you're rich and you use it. Maybe that's what it is, but I'm not sure. I don't know how this answers
the
riddle.
Just
a second, yeah? Maybe, yeah?
What did it mean when it bends?
I guess it bends in the wind. When it's growing, it bends in the wind, and when the wind passes through it, it makes a howl. So the queen of Sheba said to him, I never believed I'd see such a wise man, and everything they told me is half of your wisdom. It doesn't even come close. Praised are your men, praised are your servants. And the king brought her into his chambers, and when she saw all his wealth, she praised Hashem. She praised Hashem for choosing him to be over the people, a just king. And she gave him a lot of gold and silver. And the king also gave her, Shlomo Amalek gave her whatever she wanted. All the kings, when they heard of Shlomo's great wisdom, were fearful of him, and they came to honor him with wealth. Now, when our kingdom went down, so Shlomo's son already did not have the great wisdom of Shlomo, and because Shlomo, towards the end of his lifetime, erred, his wives caused him to err, so God decreed that the kingdom would be split. And Shlomo's son is king over the southern half, and the northern half is given over to the 10 tribes, set up their own monarchy, their own series of kings. And the 10 northern tribes are exiled by the Assyrian king Sanherib. And he comes trying to conquer Jerusalem. God sends out an angel who kills 1,800,000 men at the gates of Jerusalem. All his men are standing there and they all die. An angel kills them. We couldn't take on such a force. But one escapes, and his name is Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar establishes the Babylonian kingdom, and his kingdom overtakes the Assyrian kingdom, which isn't so difficult after 1,800,000 soldiers have died. The first year he's king, he takes over Nineveh, which is the capital of Ashur, capital of the Assyrian kingdom. And the second year, he goes down and captures Jerusalem. He captures the southern tribes which remained in Israel, and the southern king Jehoiakim is subservient to him. 3 years he serves him, and then he decides to rebel, even though he promised him he wouldn't rebel. And after 3 years war, Nebuchadnezzar captures him and kills him and establishes his son Jehoiakim as king instead of him, and returns to Babylon. And when he returns to Babylon, his wise men tell him, are you nuts? From a bad dog you don't get a good puppy. If the father rebelled, then the son will rebel as well. And so he does an about face and returns the following year, the ninth year of his reign. He returns to Jerusalem and takes the son Jehoiachin into exile and puts him in bondage. And when he takes Jehoiachin, he takes not only Jehoiachin but all the great leaders of Jerusalem, all the great wise men. And one of the wise men he honors, he does not take him, and his name is Mordechai. And Mordechai willingly says, I'm going with my people. I'm not letting all the wise men and leaders go out to Babylon, and I'm going to stay here. I'm going with them. And so Mordechai willingly exiles himself out to Babylon, and ultimately he's going to travel to Shushan, the capital. Mordechai was already an elder. He was one of those who sat on the Lishkas Agazis. good question. Yeah, Mordechai in our Megillah, which occurs 70 years later, is in excess of 100 probably. He was exiled. Okay, we'll see. We shall see. We don't know how old he had to be. Maybe he was very, very wise and he joined the Lishkas Agazas, the top court, at age 20, 25. We don't know. I don't know, at least. I don't have a source for it. There are sources that discuss his age and everyone agrees he was very old. There are sources that discuss Esther being an old lady as well. That'll make Esther very old also, right? Which makes it even more miraculous that the king would fall for her.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll get to that, yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, yes.
Why would he leave Mordechai there out of everybody?
Good question. Maybe out of respect. We find that when the sages were exiled, Jeremiah, the kings so valued his wisdom that they said, "You do what you want." And Jeremiah chose to go with the exile until God told him, "Go back to Jerusalem." God sent him back. So maybe with Mordechai it was the same thing. Out of honor, they respected who he was, so they didn't force him to do anything.
But they forced everybody else.
They forced everyone else, right.
He wasn't the Nasi, he wasn't like the top man there. So.
He was one of the top. Yeah, Mordechai was one of the top. So this great throne is captured, and it goes from the hands of the Egyptian king to the Babylonian king, till finally it ends up by Ahasuerus. Now, we were holding years earlier the destruction of the first temple, so Jeremiah keeps warning the Jews the temple will be destroyed, and there are thousands of false prophets telling them it won't be destroyed, don't worry, everything's going to be okay, and Jeremiah keeps saying it will, and eventually they call him a traitor, they try to kill him, until his disciple Baruch ben Neriah saves him. Jeremiah is thrown into a pit of tar, and they're going to let him sink and drown, and his disciple comes and saves him, and the king repents. Now, when Nebuchadnezzar removed Jehoiachin, who was Jehoiachin's son, from office, he took him into prison in Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar then established his cousin Matanya and changed his name to Tzidkiyahu. And he made Matanya promise he wouldn't rebel. And there's a whole long story about how Matanya once walked in when Nebuchadnezzar was eating a live rabbit, and Tzidkiyahu told him, "Tzevir Minachai, you're commanded not to eat parts of live animals. How could you eat it before it's dead?" And he made him promise that he would never reveal it. And then Tzidkiyahu went to the sages and he had his vow annulled, and then he told the sages the vow, and basically he rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar came back, and as the prophet Jeremiah forewarned Tzidkiyahu, he said, "You're going to be blinded, your kids will be slaughtered, and you will ultimately be killed. You're going to be taken in shackles out to Babylon." And when Nebuchadnezzar comes in, so he sees a few things. Tzidkiyahu was no fool, but he had a secret tunnel leading outside the city, and he kept thinking, "You know what? When the city's captured, I'll make it out. Even if the city's captured, I have my tunnel." So he took his children, and when he saw the city was captured, he went through his tunnel. Now, God had told him he'd be caught, so God made it that Nebuchadnezzar's men were hunting a deer, and the deer led them to the entrance. They chased after the deer, so it led them to the entrance of the cave. And when they got there, they see Tzidkiyahu coming out with his children, and they grab him. And they bring him before Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar asks him, "Didn't you promise me you would never tell?" And he says, "Yeah, I did." So he says, "Doesn't your Torah says you have to keep a vow?" So he says, "Yeah, but our Torah also gives us an opening that we could go and have it annulled by the rabbis." So he said, "Oh, the rabbis are willing to annul a vow like this?" So he went and started killing out the rabbis. That's one thing Nebuchadnezzar did. And the next thing Nebuchadnezzar did was he entered the temple and he saw blood bubbling on the ground. So he asked them, "What is that?" So they said, "It must be from a sacrifice." So he said, "I've seen blood from animals and it stops bubbling. That blood's still bubbling." So he brings one animal and he slaughters it, and he looks at the blood, he says, "It's not the same blood." He brings another animal, he brings every animal he could, he said, "That's not animal blood, that's human blood. I want the true story." So they tell him the true story about the great prophet Zechariah, who was Kohen Gadol, who saved the king Yoshiyahu while his mother was trying to murder all the offsprings of King David. He saved him, and then his own son, that king who he saved his life, his son started sinning, and the prophet came in and warned him, and he told him, "You shouldn't be sinning." And he killed him on the spot there in the temple, a prophet and a high priest. And that blood remained there for years bubbling because God said, I have to avenge his blood. How could it be that the man who saved his father's life, thanks to him he's alive, he kills him on Yom Kippur, on Shabbos, in the temple? And that's what it says in Eicha, in Yareg b'Mikdash Hashem Kohen v'Navi. How could it be in God's temple? The Jewish people say, God, how could you do this to us? And God says, well, what did you do? You know how to ask me questions. I have questions for you. How could you kill on the temple mount a Kohen and a Navi? And when Nebuchadnezzar saw this, he said, okay, I'll avenge your blood. And he started killing. And he killed one Jew after another, and children, and after he'd killed tens of thousands, he came to the blood and he said, are you never going to rest? And the blood stopped bubbling. So Nebuchadnezzar has seen great miracles. And Nebuchadnezzar thinks, I came here with over 1 million soldiers, and God sent out an angel and destroyed the camp. And I was the only one who made it out alive. And now, I made it here, I was able to destroy the temple, I was able to capture all of God's holy vessels. I am great. I am the greatest. And Nebuchadnezzar takes the Jews out into captivity, out to Babylon. Yeah?
I'm not sure if it's a different timeline or what. He also saw the hand with the...
So we'll get to that. That's not him. We're doing a quick overview of everything up to the Megillah. We'll get to that. So Nebuchadnezzar, in his 19th year, 10 years after he exiled Yehoiachin, Nebuchadnezzar exiles Tzidkiyo, destroys the temple, brings everyone out to Babylon. He takes Jewish children, among them Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and educates them, and these children are going to be his advisors. 2 years after he destroys the temple, he has a dream, and he sees a huge idol. The head is of gold, the chest is of silver, the waist is of copper, and the feet are of metal and earthenware. And in his dream, he sees a rock showing up out of nowhere, crushing the idol down to dust, to the size of chaff, like the chaff off of a kernel. And the wind blows it away, and then this rock becomes a huge mountain. And no one can interpret the dream. He forgets the dream. He asks for interpreters. Daniel walks in, and he reveals the dream and interprets it. And after hearing the interpretation and understanding that the Jewish people are represented by that rock, which is the mountain, and they're going to take over everything, Nebuchadnezzar says, I have to bump the Jews. They are my nemesis. Even though God exiled them, their prophet Jeremiah said after 70 years, God's bringing them back, and they're going to overtake all the kingdoms. Everything is going to be overtaken by the Jews. So he says, how do I do that? I make them sin. And he builds a grand idol out in a valley of Dura, where there are bones of many, many Jews who went against the king and were dead, and their bodies were left there to rot. And now he takes them out to that valley, and he says, everyone must bow to the idol, and everyone does bow. And when they bow to that idol, up in heavens, God says, you bow to the idol? So I'm going to let Haman take over. You bow to a piece of gold? So he built a huge idol. So what? You bow to it? I'm going to let Haman decree. But the Jews didn't mean it when they bowed. When the Jews bowed to the idol, they said, we don't believe that's God, but we're going to die otherwise. So God says, okay, so I'll let the decree be written, but I won't mean it either, and I'll let it be annulled. And that's the story of Purim. But the story of Purim is the decree, and the Jews didn't know that God didn't mean it. So, three do not bow to that idol, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, Daniel as well, and those three are thrown into the furnace and come out alive. Nebuchadnezzar dreams of a great tree being cut down, and the roots remaining in the ground, and that tree represents himself. God punishes him for his thoughts that he is the greatest and he overtook God's castle. God makes him into an animal, and for 7 years he roams the world like an animal. His son Belshazzar, his son Evil-Merodach takes the throne after his passing. He's been king for 45 years, and Evil-Merodach is a righteous person. Evil-Merodach first says, God doesn't want the Jewish people harmed this way. I saw the miracles he did. So he starts helping the Jews. He takes the king Yechoniah and he takes him out of jail. And the people love him. They recognize he's a God-fearing person. And he's a good, good king. And then his brother Belshazzar takes the throne at his passing. And in Belshazzar's first year, Daniel has a dream of four wild animals goring one another. And those four animals represent the four kingdoms of the world. And in his third year, he has a war with the Persian Mede Empire, Paras and Madai. They're the up-and-coming force in the world. Around Iran, yeah.
I don't know the technicality of these, but I mean, it says he had a dream and then after this happened. So is there anything in the dream required that he had to do after, like, the day after he had that dream?
Daniel, no.
Okay.
But that's for when we learn Daniel. It's a good question. We're obviously doing a whole book of Daniel in short version and 20 chapters in Malachim.
I've seen anybody who has a dream where they recommend.
So we will have a session of question and answer after the after this.
Okay.
So bring it up, okay? So in Belshazzar's third year, he has war with the Persian Empire. He wins the great battle and he rejoices. And when he rejoices, he starts taking out all his gold vessels, and everyone looks at them, and they know what the kingly vessels of the temple looked like. And his vessels don't look like anything compared to that. So he decides, you know what, I'm taking out the God's vessels. Why? Because the prophet Jeremiah told the Jewish people, when Babylon has its fill of 70 years, you'll be redeemed. I will redeem you. So he says, well, let's see. 45 years passed since my father started the Babylonian Empire. 45 plus 23 of my brother Evel Merodach, that brings us to 68 plus 2 years that I was king, 70 years. The Babylonian Empire has been around 70 years, and the Jews haven't been redeemed. Must be God's not taking them back. So I could do whatever I want. So in his third year, Belshazzar takes out the vessels of the temple, and he starts using them at this party. And that night, God sends a miraculous hand, suddenly appears and writes on the wall. No one could read the writing until they call him Daniel. And Daniel reads the writing. It says, Mene, mene, tekelu parisin. You've been counted. You've been assessed. And you've been weighed in heaven, and you have not been found worthy. Your kingdom is going to be divided, parsed into the Persian Empire. And that night, one of his servants who had heard this prophecy of Daniel, interpreting the writing on the wall, so he kills him and takes his head to the Persian Mede Empire, who is standing outside the gates waiting to attack. And they attack that night, and that is the end of the Babylonian Empire and the ascent of the Persian Mede Empire. That night, as they're in the middle of their parties and everything, the Persians and Medes had attacked, and the prophet Jeremiah had, Isaiah, Yeshaya, had foretold us that that's what's going to happen. And now we have the first Persian king, the first Mede king, Darius. Now, Darius is a common term, just like Pharaoh, used for many kings. And when this year comes, so Daniel starts looking at the books, and he says the redemption should be here. Now it's been 70 years, since 2 years have passed, right? 70 years since Babylon overtook Jerusalem. The first time that Nebuchadnezzar attacked us was during his second year. So Daniel says, where is our redemption? And it doesn't come. So God gives him a prophecy where an angel reveals to him that's not the way it's going to work. Jerusalem must be destroyed for 70 years. When I said that 70 years into Babylon's rule I will redeem you, I didn't mean the temple would be built, but I'd call you back to the land of Israel. And that is why this great King Darius, who is a good friend of Daniel's, and against his better judgment and against what he can do, he's tricked into decreeing that Daniel must be thrown into the den, and then Daniel comes out of that lion's den alive. And Darius loves Daniel. He wishes Daniel well and prays for him all night that he shouldn't get killed. And Darius is only king for 1 year. Then he goes to war and gets killed, and the one who overtakes is his son-in-law, Koresh, the Persian. He is the king following Darius. And when Koresh becomes king, Koresh gives word to the Jewish people, you can all return to the land of Israel. I'll give you support, everyone should fund their relatives who are going, whoever wants should go. Now, the prophet Yeshaya, Isaiah, before the destruction of the temple, foretold us that a great king named Koresh would send us to the land of Israel. And Koresh was supposed to lead the way. He really should have said, I'm coming with you. But Koresh didn't do that. Koresh should have said, everyone go. Koresh said, whoever wants to go should go. I'll help you with the funding. And the Jews come back to the land of Israel and start rebuilding the temple. They just start, and their enemies in the land of Israel, one of which is Haman's son, Shimshi, send letter back to the king, and they say, wait a second. If these Jews rebuilt the temple, don't you know history? Whenever they had a temple, they rebelled. You want them to be loyal subjects, the best thing you could do for yourself and for them is stop the building. And they write such a convincing letter that Koresh writes a decree that the temple may not be rebuilt. So now the Jews have come to the land of Israel, laid the foundations, hoped to rebuild the temple. That part of Jeremiah's prophecy came true. 70 years into Babylon's reign over Jerusalem, the Jews were commanded to return to the land of Israel. But God didn't say 70 years after the ascent of Babylon over Jerusalem, we would be granted permission to rebuild the temple, just to return to the land. What God tells Daniel is that 70 years after the destruction of Jerusalem, then Jerusalem will be rebuilt. And we still have a few years to pass till that happens. So, in Koresh's first year, we begin, and then we are forced to stop building the temple. And now Koresh is king, and following this, Koresh is Ahasuerus, where our Megillah begins. And until Ahasuerus' son, the next Darius, Daryavish, the son of Esther, who is a Jew, he is the one that will give us permission to go back and rebuild the temple. It will be then that the 7 years will really be filled, and that is when we will really build the temple. And our Megillah begins when Ahasuerus is sitting on his throne for 3 years, and he does the math, and according to his calculation, the 70 years have been up. He does the math from the second time we were overtaken, and he says, okay, this is when the king Yehoiachin was exiled to, you remember the king Yehoiachin, the son of Yehoiachim, he was exiled 6 years later. So 6 years, he says, okay, we've got to add 6 years. When that version of calculating 70 years is up, Ahasuerus says, okay, they're not being redeemed, and he throws a party. And in that party, he brings a throne that resembles King Solomon's throne. He can't get the same thing, so he brings great technicians from Alexandria, from Egypt, and he has them try to rebuild the throne like King Solomon's. And they spend 3 years trying to build the throne that looks like King Solomon's, but they can't. They don't know how to make it that it has lions and leopards like we read, and that they'd lift him and bring him up to the top of the throne. So he makes a throne that looks just like it, but isn't really as good as it, and he sits on top. And then he makes the party. Now no one sees that the throne really isn't as smart as King Solomon's. And that's what the Megillah is stressing, that in Ahasuerus' days, when he sat on his throne, he was comfortable. 3 years into his reign, he threw a party. And this is where our Megillah begins. We're going to take a few minutes break, and we will continue.